Well, good afternoon. I'd like to thank everybody for coming to this edition of the Library Colloquia, Library Colloquia series. I'm very pleased today to have Dr. David Brenn with us. Dr. Brenn is a graduate of Caltech and earned a PhD in space physics from the University of California at San Diego. In addition to scholarly works, he has written a variety of science fiction novels, including Star Tide Rising, The Postman, and The Uplift, as well as some other books and short stories. And on behalf of Libraries, Computing, and Technology and Michigan State University, I'd like to introduce to you David Brenn.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you'd like today, and since I do so much public speaking lately, I'll leave it up to you what you want to talk about. The reason I'm here in Michigan is because in Ann Arbor they're doing a privacy series with Alan Weston and Peter Swire and some other people, and I'm the middle speaker in that series. I've been doing a lot of travel based on that topic. I was just in Zurich a week ago and Indianapolis a couple of weeks before that. I was supposed to yesterday be in New York debating William Safire and Zoe Baird on this issue at the Plaza Hotel, but they postponed that one, partly because interest is going up and people's interest in flying has gone down, so they decided it was a no-brainer to move it to March, which is better as far as I'm concerned anyway, because I'll have a book out then that I can promote. So anyway, that's all about this, which is the transparent society. Will technology force us to choose between freedom and privacy, which is a provocative title. Nonfiction is 10 times the work as a novel and for 1/10 the money, and your characters can sue you. So I try not to do nonfiction very much. But the a novel for me is easier. And it sells better. But I'll tell you, the public speaking that's come off of this one has just been amazing, because people are very interested in this topic. The notion of what are we going to do about maintaining a free society in an era of danger. And we're being faced with a major, major lie, almost a conspiratorial lie that we see on our tubes all the time in discussions of the event since September 11th. And the lie is being promoted for their own self-interest by people on both sides of a tag team match. It's like watching professional wrestlers. The security expert will come up and say, "We have got to be strong enough to understand that we're going to have to surrender some of our freedom in order to be secure." And the civil libertarian goes, "How dare you! You Orwellian Big Brother, we should have the courage to endure some insecurity for the sake of freedom." Have you ever noticed when people find it in their own interest to foist a devil's dichotomy on you? Nobody's going to tell me I have to choose between my children's freedom and my children's safety. I refuse the entire premise. I don't know about you, but where I come from, the whole notion of the zero-sum game is getting into very bad odor. You know what a zero-sum game is? It's a game in which I win a point, you lose a point. The positive-sum game is the way a civilization advances. I may win by getting 3 points, but in the process, I don't mind if you get 2. We're used to the notion of being able to have our cake, eat it too, have it grow larger, and aggressively shove pieces in the face of the poor. That's the American dream. Now, how have we achieved this? How have we accomplished it? See, our enemies see that we live very rich, happy, fun lives. And they have to come up with a rationalization for this. And the rationalization is that it cannot have happened because of virtues. Virtues such as cooperation, education, skill. moderated, even-tempered competition, cooperation. These are virtues that we use to explain our wealth. There are some cynical explanations, such as the fact that we've just finished about 400 years of picking all the low-hanging fruit from an underutilized resource of a rich continent. And some people would say that we're ripping off the poor and ripping off the third world. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Every previous civilization was shaped like this, with a few at the top lording it over those below. The golden age of Athenian democracy was an expansion of the ruling class from 1% to 7% for a brief time. Want to see a depiction of the American dream? It's a diamond. Pretty lopsided diamond, but that's us. The well-off outnumber the poor. It's never happened before in all of human civilization, and we agonize over the degree to which there are any poor at all. We argue with each other, left versus right, and all of that, over how to help them, what the proper approach is. But we're all in agreement that the children of the poor should not automatically inherit that position, whether or not we think that we should help those who are currently poor. The ideal is that this diamond floats, it rises, everybody getting better together. The poor today in America live in many ways better than kings of old. But our standards should rise as we all rise together. Now that's a different way of looking at things. It's a very different way of looking at things than the assumption of a pyramidal social structure, which was always the case in the past. See, when you look at something like this, and you're from a culture that is raised on myths of vengefulness, or you feel that your culture should have been the one to be the central kingdom of the era, to have all these advantages, you have to come up with rationalizations, and they cannot be that this culture got these things because of virtues. Because then the conclusion is that these Americans have a better model for human existence. And many people do conclude that. It's why English is becoming the world's language. It's why they're imitating our universities and send their best and the brightest here to be trained. It's a great scam. We take money from people overseas to send their best and their brightest over here to be infected with our values. We skim off the top 10% to make them into Americans and send the rest home infected with our values. And they pay us for this. Cool, good work if you can get it. No, Hitler, Stalin, Saddam, Al-Qaeda, they all have to say the same thing. We got our wealth, our freedom, our fun in a devil's exchange. We had to pay something to get it, something precious. Something more important than fun, than technology, than power, than wealth. We are Sybarites, or as Shakespeare said, epicures, decadently wallowing in our pleasures, having sacrificed, and then you can name the specifics. To this day, the Russians, talk to any Russian intellectual, and they will insist that we have no soul. That if you read Russian literature, it has more soul. More, perhaps, if you look at it from a different point of view, more whining. That's a irascible American's response. The thing that Hitler said was that we were too decadent ever to fight or to gird ourselves to produce weapons in mass quantities needed in World War II. The recent stuff from Al-Qaeda is that we sacrificed our godliness and we've sacrificed our manhood, that we're cowardly. Well, it's very interesting because I happen to believe that that what we've got resulted from virtues. They aren't necessarily exactly what we've been taught in school. We're taught, for instance, that these checks and balances in our Constitution are what kept us free. But if you look at the history of Latin America in the early 1800s, almost every newly freed country in Latin America copied our Constitution with its institutional checks and balances, and not one of them stayed free. Something more fundamental is at work. Some of you may be familiar with the term memes. Memes are ideas that are infectious, that carry from person to person. Just like viruses can go from computer to computer, or an organic virus can go from organism to organism. An idea that happens to have the trait of making you think about it is alive, in a sense, in your brain. It reproduces if you think it's cool enough to tell others. In other words, I just coughed on you with the meme, the self-replicating idea of memes, of self-replicating ideas. It had the trait of making me interested in it enough to think that you should be interested in it too. Now, is it a conscious entity that makes me do that? No, of course not. A virus isn't a conscious entity either. Those memes that happen to fall into the trait of making the host want to tell others about it are just like the flu viruses that happened into the trait of making people cough. And so this is an infectious notion that I've just coughed on you. It's the idea of these self-replicating ideas. Now, let's say you were to add to this the idea, the notion that these ideas may also have other traits. What if a meme were to have the trait of making a culture paranoid about other memes, trying to keep out competing ideas and make sure that their children are similarly infected with the same thing that they believe? Does this start sounding familiar? Does it sound like the exclusionary religious and cultural themes that many cultures have had? No, we must protect our children from infection by alien ideas. Throughout history, two notions about ideas have fought with each other, and almost always one has won. And that is the notion, the model of human beings as being frail. You must protect, an elite must protect the masses against infection by deleterious ideas that would be harmful to them. Only once in history have you had a civilization whose principal moral messages conveyed in all of its mythic systems and in its schools has been the maturity principle. There have been people who preached it throughout history, but it's only once has there been a time when the maturity principle was the official dominant morality, and that is you can raise children with critical faculties such that they can be exposed to all ideas, pick and choose elements from them, and make a cohesive internal worldview that's tolerant of diversity and interested in new inputs. And that's us. That's this civilization. We don't give ourselves credit for having made this transition because we believe in it so passionately that we are spending most of our time criticizing ourselves about the degree to which we have not lived up to it. Right? Most of you are highly critical of the degree to which our culture has not lived up to that ideal that I just described, right? Elitists. One of the worst things we have in our culture is a tendency to need to feel superior to the masses. I'm highly critical of it. And yet, I suddenly realized one day that my criticism of this need, this tendency of our elites to feel smugly superior to the masses, that when I'm criticizing that, what am I doing? I'm feeling smugly superior to the masses of elites. In other words, I'm caught in the same trap. It feels good, doesn't it? It feels real good to be superior to the masses. And I've got my even better trip. I'm superior to the masses of elites. Yeah. A profound sensitivity to cliches is really my only real talent. Here's one for you, and it's related to this topic. Isn't it awful that our wisdom has not kept up with our technology? Jenny's heard this before. She'll hear it probably this evening when I speak at UM. Isn't it awful that our wisdom hasn't kept up with our technology? How about the metaphor of the movie 2001? I mean, I can't count the number of guys who watch 2001. They say, oh, man, it's 2001. We don't have all those toys. Where's the whirling space stations going around or Strauss waltzes? Where are the talking robots? Where's all that stuff? Well, it turns out those things are hard. Take a look at the movie from a social perspective. It's a civilization utterly dominated by smug, patronizing white males who are keeping secret for the good, for their own good, for the good of society, from society, a piece of information. What was it Haywood Floyd says? We all know the potential for cultural disorientation and shock in this discovery. What is they discovered a magnetic rock under the moon's surface that might have been deliberately buried 4 million years ago. Ooh. Cultural disorientation and shock. This from a director who planned, was hoping that millions of people of that same civilization would go and watch their movie. Contempt. We don't have that civilization today. If that scenario happened today and some NASA official said, we're going to keep this secret, some of the astronauts would have said, up yours. I'm going to the press. Moreover, the spaceship would have had at least one woman aboard who would have listened to poor Hal instead of driving him into a paranoid frenzy with their bullying. In other words, what's interesting to me is we may have adjusted our priorities in ways that are very surprising, given our cliches. You look around this room, we are a better people than we were. And the difference in our wisdom appears to be far greater than the difference in our technology. When I was a kid, you went to the airport and picked up grandma. All right, so you exchanged emails beforehand instead of a telephone call. Big deal. You still go to the airport and you pick up grandma. All right, she has to be scanned more. Think of the 1920s, when middle-class people got radios, telephones, automobiles, refrigerators, and we're starting to think about, hey, Marge, someday we'll fly through the sky like those brave young men are doing. Maybe not this year. Let's try for it next year. I hear there's a barnstormer coming to town. Big difference in human life. Much bigger than the difference between his generation and mine, except we wore better clothes and had worse hair. Every generation has to think that they invented black leather. You know, it's important. Well, I thought I'd set a few themes, but some of this is what I'm going to be talking about this evening at UM. So maybe what I should do is open things up a little more. I will show you a few of the things that I'm up to. This is my new novel. And for those of you who would like, I have book plates that I can sign. The book itself is not out yet. Provocative title, eh? Kiln People. I don't know. Might have been a mistake. The premise is that you take the notion of the golem, the clay figure who could be animated, and go back to the Sumerian epoch and think about that they actually mystically believed in this new art of writing, that you could actually roll with a cylinder seal, roll your soul in the clay, that the writing actually made something, an imbuement of your own soul in the clay. I thought about that, and I thought, each generation has its own wish fulfillment from the previous generation. Our grandparents got to move. They got social mobility. They got to fly. We got the point where we can access the world's information at our fingertips. What if you could have another dream come true, the dream of being able to be in two places at once? So the people in this world, if your home copier, you lay yourself down on the home copier, you press the start button, and out comes a clay golem model of you with all of your memories, all of your thoughts, an imprinted copy of your soul. And it can go out and do stuff. And at the end of the day, download what it's learned, its memories at the end of the day. Now, from one perspective, half the world's population is these clay slaves. And it sounds kind of dystopic. From another point of view, you see people splitting themselves in two, going and doing different things, coming back together at the end of the day. What's the problem here? In fact, this guy says, I never would have made it through college without all those high intensity, high concentration grades I sent to the library. Wouldn't you like that? I'd spend my day at the beach. that was good. Now, what did I learn today? Oh, cool. Wish fulfillment. I went to Caltech. I sure wished I had something like that. So that's one thing I'm working on. Just had my first comic book. 90-page hardcover graphic novel set in the Star Trek universe. Reifying a story that whose original idea I had in 1967, watching Shatner and Nimoy prance around in velour pullovers. Just goes to show, don't throw away anything from your trunk. Someday you may use it. Yes, even when you look like this. What else? Just fixing up my website so you can find out all sorts of new cool things. I published recently a web essay talking about the events of September 11th. And I'll be talking about that to some degree this evening. Pointing out that the events that day that were important, significant, were not the harmful ones, but the interesting way in which people adapted. Almost all of the video taken that day was from private cameras. Almost all of the useful communications was over private cell phones. And the only effective actions taken in real time against terror were taken by private individuals using their own intelligence network of cell phones, holding a rapid committee meeting at the back of UA 93 and deciding to change a 40-year doctrine of surrender to hijackers in real time there on the spot, without waiting for any government committees, without waiting for any deliberation. They decided on the spot to change the doctrine using something, one of our virtues, called initiative. And whereas the heroes on UA 93 have been eulogized as heroes, I haven't seen anybody point out the fundamental thing that was going on here, and that is that we were defended by amateurs. Now, not with total effectiveness. It might have been nice if somebody had told them, push the thrust controls all the way forward, and the biggest guy's job is to just grab the controller while we fight. That might have helped. A little not professional knowledge would have been helpful, but the 20th century has been one long monotonic increase in our reliance on professionals. And to the degree that it's been moderated by our mythic system so that it never resulted in a bureaucratic, oppressive tyranny, although there are people who would disagree with me about that, who think that we do have that. Nevertheless, it's an oppressive notion that this would continue into the 21st century. The total professionalization of everything. The patronizing, the pat on the head, the you can't do that because our liability insurance won't cover it. Suddenly the president's on saying, volunteer with your local hospital, volunteer with your local fire department. When several thousand burly men showed up at the site, the fire department did not turn them away as his policy. They needed them and used them. The notion that amateurs and volunteers and irregulars will be of great importance in the future now seems patently obvious. A couple of years ago, I said it at a Defense Department meeting and got this glazed look. I said, 50 years ago, gosh, 60 years ago, the professional soldiers were fighting and dying on Bataan to buy us time. And 3 million men signed up. And it took a while to train them. It took a while to equip them. It took a while to ship them. And the thin gray line died to buy them time, knowing that they would be coming. What are you going to do with your 12 divisions? What are you going to do? You're so gone down the road of professionalism. You assume that it takes a year just to train a young man to be able to take advanced training in the military. You would not know what to do with 2 million adult volunteers. You have no plans. They have no plans. Not even any concept studies of what to do with 2 million volunteers. It's amazing. Looking ahead and finding where the quicksand is, where the snares are, where the snake pits are, is difficult to do when you are running into the future as fast as you can. There are those who believe that we should be running into the future a little slower so that we can poke sticks. Now, there are two ways we use these prefrontal lobes, the lamps above the brow, that are the ways in which we project ourselves into the future. One is anticipation and the other is resiliency. Anticipation is where you try to figure out where the threats are and create countermeasures in advance. Resiliency is creating a system that knows that it will trip and is resilient enough not to fall. I mean, which of these two, if you had to choose between them? The professional temptation is to say anticipation. The amateur's response is resiliency. Well, I've been bouncing around. I could talk about this, I could talk about that, I could talk about the Postman movie if you like. Hey, I know. Let's all get the word out that people should rent once more a movie that was too patriotic for its time, but mayhaps now seems a little bit appropriate. Postal workers being heroes in the face of a world of bioterrorism. Or you could get me started on The X-Files. Ooh, The X-Files. The whole premise of The X-Files is fascinating. Here are 100 or so officers of the United States government who went to school with us, married our sisters, who are violating their sacred trusts and oaths of office, risking imprisonment and execution in order to kidnap, brainwash, and murder their fellow citizens with the goal of keeping us desperately from knowing a secret that, if revealed, is the one piece of information that would make us willing to double our taxes. I don't get it. Your whole purpose is to keep secret from us something that would be willing to give you all raises. It's kind of painful, but it's part and parcel of the unexamined, most profoundly relentless propaganda campaign the world has ever been subjected to. It outdoes Nazi wartime propaganda, Stalin, even the Catholic Church. Suspicion of authority. And none of you were thinking of it. And yet, if you think about it, it's obvious. Can you name a single popular film that you've enjoyed in the last 30 years in which you did not bond with the central character the moment that character stuck it to some authority figure? It is the classic technique by which you bond the audience to the central character. The character must do something eccentric. The character must do something to an authority figure. Tolerance has been sort of like a Pancho sidekick character throughout this. Another relentless message. And we're talking about a war between the deep messages that children absorb at a very early age. A guy I know is a scholar in the Farsi language, the language of Iran. He says every single traditional fairy tale that the kids listen to at night when they're being put to bed focuses on a theme of revenge. I mean, look at the 1001 Arabian Nights. When you get right down to it, look at Grimm's fairy tales. We passed through this phase. Either revenge stories or macho quests. Or rescue, sexually highly stratified rescue stories. But the thing is, these same kids then hear from their big brother who's been to the American University other things, and then they watch Farsi language Sesame Street in the morning. And what does Sesame Street say about revenge? Oh, Big Bird, we don't do that. It's a different meme. It's a different mental process that's being promulgated. Different sets of virtues. And it's pointless to some degree to say it's all different points of view, it's all relativist, because when you say that, you are waving the flag for your point of view. You're waving the flag for a point of view that says, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let ideas compete. Whose flag are you waving? Excuse me, the one that you were raised under. Us, ours. Not us Republican, us Democrat, not us American, not us Californian. Us in a deeper sense. Of the people who believe in the maturity model of dealing with ideas, that children can be raised so that they have critical faculties and can make up their own minds. This is the fundamental premise of science fiction. Science fiction is based upon the premise that children can learn from the mistakes of their parents. Not that they will. In fact, when children obstinately don't learn from the mistakes of your parents, you get really good tragedy. In his Tragedics, Aristotle said that tragedy should be, by a recipe, showing a victim of the gods futilely flailing against preordained fate. And if you watch Oedipus, you will weep. But if you're American, you also want to leap on the stage, use one bullet to put him out of his misery, and use the remaining five chambers to hunt down the gods. And that was what was so charming. You can sometimes find this in popular culture, lower level popular culture. Like, did any of you ever watch Xena, Warrior Princess, or Hercules? Never? Snooty intellectuals. Okay, he admits it. It was charming stuff. Delightful. It would take you to, the one episode would be about the story of Balder and the mistletoe. Another would be Shiva and Kali. They'd go all over the place. But the one common theme is that Hercules and Xena were going to get it to the gods. And if they put a king, lost king, back in power, he had better be seen. I'm rebuilding alongside my people, Xena. See, Xena? Otherwise, she'll kick him out too. Charming. Very American view of ancient myths. Rebellious. Yeah, I'm going to say basically something that I sometimes do with audiences. You've heard this, Jenny. We need to go forward and crush every worldview that doesn't preach tolerance. Oh, Jenny, this is one of the scary ones. Three of them smiled and the rest of them went, Laugh! Hello, it was funny! I'm not going to trust you guys with that power. Maybe I didn't deliver the line well. It was ironic. People with that power can be trusted only if they recognize the internal irony of it all.
Oh yeah, let's go forth and crush intolerance. Yeah, crush them.
If this worldview wins, there will be Bantu dancers, whirling dervishes, and any kind of cultural difference you want. They will have been eviscerated down at their deepest core. Because the thing that made them deeply what they were, the paranoia, the machismo, these other homogenizing tendencies, will have been surgically removed. You will have a world of diversity, but not complete diversity. Paranoia is not compatible with peace. Intolerance is not compatible with tolerance. They don't work together. To an extent, this is a war. And on another level, it's just teaching people to chill out and have some fun. It's the same thing on different levels. It's just whether or not you want to be provoked by this crazy Californian science fiction author who's deliberately poking away at you, as I think you've noticed by now. All right, have you been provoked enough? Want to poke back? Or ask questions? There's a lot of different stuff going on here. Pick.
We can talk golems, if you like.
I'd just like to point out that you can get amateur scarves and things from the Union. You can pull that out in Ann Arbor and antagonize them that way.
Would somebody like to go and fetch me an MSU scarf? Well, you know, I had the good sense not to bring my OSU stuff. That I knew would be suicidal.
I find your talk to be nutritious. I want to ask you many questions. I'd like to say, damn you, Dr. Brin, for stealing my idea. Of course, you didn't really steal it. You just wrote it down before I thought it out fully, the idea of killing people. It seems to me that if you had a cloned mind, a low-down-load sort of thing, and a cloned body, you call that a Zox, as the transhumanists do. And I thought it would be awfully, awfully fun to have about four of these, doing all the hobbies and all the reading and everything else. Of course, I'd read when I was uploaded so that I wouldn't waste time reading in a slow way with my eyes. And it would be great fun.
Thanks for coming.
The populist aspect is kind of odd. I mean, if everybody did it, what would society look like?
But that's an extremely good point. It's an extremely good point because literarily speaking, by the way, if any of you are going to leave and you actually are book likers, I can sign a book plate for killing people. But only if you think there's a chance you might want to buy the book and slip it in. One of the cliches that I'm very sensitive to is called the idiot plot. There's a rule in Hollywood, thou shalt never show any American institutions functioning well. And the reason is because, it's not because, except for Oliver Stone, most of these directors don't actually believe they live in a horrible world where no one would come if you dial 911. They just have a real problem. If skilled professionals come when you dial 911, then it becomes a police procedural and they pat you on the head and they say, you did great work escaping those bad guys in the first act. There are no more acts for you. We'll protect you now. You have to really write well in order for you to keep your hero in jeopardy for 90 minutes in the context of a skilled society. So most writers and most directors simply don't. They simply assume imbecility and that nothing works. If you dial 911 and they come efficiently and well, then they are in cahoots with the bad guy. If they come and they're late and are clumsy, then they'll provide some comic relief backup in Act 3. And the exceptions really are interesting. Silence of the Lambs, The Fugitive, in which society made a single mistake, which is of course totally plausible and very different from saying that all of society's institutions are corrupt and stupid. Society making a single mistake is exactly what accountability and what I call in here social T-cells are all about. The poking of the sticks as quickly as possible as we're running into the future cannot be done by skilled professionals alone. It must be done by millions of self-righteous, indignant, highly educated individuals, unleashed upon errors in a stochastic, random way. It's amazing how we developed this, just as we're charging into the future, but it's not so amazing when you realize that this is the system that results in the fecundity of creativity that allows us to charge into the future. So discovering errors in advance in a stochastic way by unleashing stoked up, self-righteous, indignant, individualistic, eccentric, and highly educated people on potential error modes from a diversity of political perspectives is the only possible way we could survive. Well, that's a completely different viewpoint than you're used to thinking about left, right, and all these things. But it has to be right or we're dead. I mean, we're living in an area that's habitable because people picketed Three Mile Island. And the utility said, just to make you idiots happy, we'll add three extra pumps. What was I getting at? Oh, yes. One of the cliches is, if something new comes along, you put it into the hands of a secretive mad scientist, a secretive government agency, a secretive Zaibatsu Corporation, or a secretive criminal cabal. That way, the story writes itself. See? Whereas, I'm not interested in that. I find that boring. We've been preached to by, for instance, in one of the things I do in some of my novels is called Uplift, the raising up of animals to human-level intelligence. Well, Cordwainer Smith did it. Pierre Boulez did it, Planet of the Apes, H.G. Wells did it. In every single case, the assumption was we would automatically be cruel and vicious toward these creatures, enslaving them. Well, that was a useful morality tale, and because of that, the self-preventing prophecy. That's not what we're going to do, is it? If we start raising chimpanzees and dolphins, first off, it'll be prevented by the goody two-shoes, because it's meddling in something that already has its own nobility of spirit. If we did this with the best of intentions, wouldn't such creatures still have interesting problems? You see, here's the point. If you don't assume everybody's idiots, you can still have a good story. And it's much more realistic, because what do we do with new things? Do we hide them in secret government cabals? Or do we bottle them and sell it to everybody? The latter is more common. And that's what I did in here. I depicted a world in which there was some flirtation with the rich having it, and it didn't work. Everybody does it. And that's becoming my trademark. It's one of the reasons why I think so highly of Steven Spielberg and have such contempt for George Lucas, even though people often say them in the same breath. I have a relatively infamous essay on my website about Star Wars. And it was suicidal for me to write it and publish it because it means that a quarter of Hollywood will never do business with me. But it had to be said. It's a profoundly evil universe. Deeply, deeply disturbing. Even more than Harry Potter. And that's pretty disturbing. It's, you look at the Lucas's image of the hero as being a pure demigod who, if tempted by the slightest anger, will turn evil. The man probably never spoke to a real hero in his life. And then you look at Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan. And the agony, the self-reproach, the stumbles and falls that a real hero endures, and the getting up and wiping off and trying to straighten and stumbling forward and trying somehow to become, go back to your humanity and finding it again. Spielberg understands this intensely. It's the exact opposite of the message that Lucas gives. Young Skywalker, pick up this lightsaber and cut off my head, and the galaxy will see a fluorescence of freedom. Your friends will all be saved, but you'll turn into a bad person. No! Excuse me. Okay.
Leia, am I a bad person?
You remember the very end of Saving Private Ryan? The very end of Private Ryan is exactly the answer to that. He turns to the one person qualified, his wife, and says, have I been okay? She says, what the hell are you talking about? Of course. And that's what he needed. The difference between these two men is staggering. Nobody talks about it. Anyway, I think I answered your question. I hope I did. Anybody else? Yeah.
Well, I worry.
Well, I don't mind crushing bad guys. I mind doing it stupidly. And I think this whole Afghanistan thing, and I'm saying this now with the good guys rolling forward, is a profoundly stupid thing. Nobody stopped even for a minute to ask, what could Bin Laden's plan have been? What could he have wanted us to do? Excuse me, duh, go to Afghanistan? I mean, those are three words that are guaranteed to cause any empire pain for the last 4,000 years. Now, it's true, we are profoundly more competent than anybody else, and we can sometimes take on challenges that nobody else has taken on. Clinton is getting no credit from the right wing. I just returned from Europe. Clinton is massively popular over there for the one truly successful war that we've fought in our generation, and that's the war in the Balkans. We had a couple of successful raids in Grenada and Panama. But the only truly successful war we have fought that involved some violence in the last 40 years was Clinton's war in the Balkans. He gets no credit for it whatsoever, even though the Europeans think he's just short of God for what he did there. Because it required patience, it required adaptability. No, I think what we needed to do, I think what we needed to do was not do what Bin Laden wants us to do, but instead think about what could accomplish the most desirable ends. And in this case, the absolute most desirable end is to have CNN pictures of our soldiers being kissed. Because that cuts the tit-for-tat revenge cycle. Everything we do in Afghanistan, even if we have the maximum possible victory there and put in a friendly government, is going to result in hundreds of thousands of new recruits among the semi-educated, not the ill-educated, but the semi-educated young males of Pakistan and Indonesia. But you can cut the cycle if it's obvious that we were welcomed and that we were glad, that someone was glad to be there. And there's a way we could have done it. There's a place that we could have gone that absolutely no possibility of guerrilla warfare. It would have fixed an old crime that we committed, and it could possibly have removed two nations from our enemy list, two large, dangerous nations from our enemy's list. Go back to southern Iraq, 50 miles from our bases, easy to get to, lousy territory for guerrilla warfare. Anybody see the movie Three Kings? It was actually pretty good. Go back to the people we betrayed. Kick Saddam's Republican Guard out of there and say to the Shiites there, all right, we're sorry, we're back now. Saddam will never come and bother you again. And then what we do is we say to the Iranians, we've got a deal for you. 5-year protectorate over your Shiite brethren and their holy sites, 5 years use of the oil of southern Iraq. In exchange, all you have to do is forgive us. For whatever it is you think we did, for anything, give us a piece of paper. We'll say I'm sorry. Here's some oil. Here's a victory over your enemy. Forgive us. People who understand the Middle Eastern personality have to understand that forgiveness is almost as passionate as hatred. It can be impulsive and hugely passionate. And it would have been worth a try to be able to remove both Iraq and Iran from our enemies' list. Then there would be an underlying benefit to that. Because when the Shah was our friend, we did not have to suck up to Saudi Wahhabism. Most of the terrorists were Saudis. Most of the money was Saudi. And yet our leaders are absolutely refusing to pay any attention whatsoever to the fact that it all comes out of Riyadh. Every last bit of it comes out of Riyadh. It's a fanatical cult. It always has been a fanatical cult. And they are bound and determined with a long-range plan to destroy us. And if we got Iran back as a friend, we wouldn't have to suck up to them anymore. You know why this won't happen? Colin Powell will never let anything like it happen because it would implicitly imply that he made a mistake in 92. This is one of the most overrated public figures that I've ever seen.
What if they went in now and in Afghanistan and said, we are sorry, forgive us for not staying here after the Russians were pushed out?
Well, asking for forgiveness is a thing that we consider to be moderately shameful, but that would be a very good ploy under many circumstances. Forgive us for our past crimes. We're sorry. We're sorry we toppled Mossadegh. We're sorry we were insensitive in the past. It's a good thing. It's an agile, resilient thing that we should be doing. But I don't want to pay any attention to Afghanistan. I wish we weren't there now. Fine. Let's make the best of what's going on now. I would rather there be a friendly government there than an unfriendly one. I'll take a victory. I'll pat Powell on the head for having done it. But it's meanwhile, what's going on in the streets of Islamabad and Jakarta is horrible. We're radicalizing hundreds of thousands of young men. Every day this is going on. It's not benefiting us. And sure, I think we're surprising bin Laden. Just because he had a plan and we're falling for it doesn't mean his plan was smart. He's a deluded imbecile who thinks he could take us on. Well, everybody who's ever tried that has learned that it's very painful to take us on. It's a mistake, and he made a mistake. I mean, there's many ways in which this thing is just totally. For just a few examples of how they've paid horribly for this. You see a movie out there with Robert Redford demonizing the Chinese. It's called Spy Game. There's another one talking about a guy trapped behind enemy lines in Serbia. They're both totally obsolete. One, the Serbian war is over. Two, all of a sudden China's our best pal. Because the East and Russia are suddenly locking arms with us. And all the little disputes are suddenly being settled. Because they're both scared to death of the same thing that's scaring us right now. Now, what stronger favor could he have done? Give up a couple of buildings in exchange for getting the Russians and the Chinese to suddenly be extremely cooperative? The IRA is putting down their weapons because after September 11th, not a penny was coming from Boston and New York to Sinn Féin. All of the European terror groups except ETA have folded up their tents. The consolidation of the Western camp has been incredible. And we lost only twice as many people as died at Pearl Harbor. Heroes of that, you talk about heroes of that day. How about the architects who built those buildings so that everybody below the crash levels got away? Everybody except the firemen who were running in got away. And we didn't achieve this because of virtues. No, there are all sorts of silver linings. There are all sorts of ways in which things are going in surprising ways. No. The people who did this were idiots. Timothy McVeigh was an idiot. Bright idiots can do harm. And this is going to happen more and more as the power to do harm gets democratized and spread out.
Do you think that Bush says that Afghanistan mission by the Russian president said that Russian troops will not go to Afghanistan for the same reason we would never go to Vietnam again? So if they control the press, so we don't know what's really going on. Two, if he captures or kills bin Laden, or We'll only stay so long.
Well, absolutely. We mustn't be seen as occupiers.
Right. Well, also the Vietnam West. We can't win there. They know we can't.
Well, the Powell Doctrine has been a calamity. It allowed Saddam to build up on the Kuwaiti border, ignored the signs that he was going to go, sent him conflicting signals, and then when he got in, responded with immense force. Now, we're just lucky that he chose when he did to attack. I mean, talk about our enemies being idiots. Had Saddam invaded Kuwait 2 years earlier, we would have had to keep most of those troops in Europe where they were facing an active Warsaw Pact. Had he invaded 2 years later, most of those troops would have been disbanded. He happened to choose a moment in time when an entire United States and NATO field army was fully trained, fully fueled, fully equipped, ready to face brutal warfare against a gigantic enemy and take horrible casualties. And the enemy had gone, was gone. And here was this army only 700 miles away. Dumb. The entire 7th Corps could just be swung around, planted, and still he gave us, 10 weeks to get them set up. Now, some of our military are actually fairly smart. For For instance, they've downgraded the importance of the main battle tank, the M1A1 tank. Why? It was such a huge success in Desert Storm. One guy said to me, because we know that no enemy will ever again allow themselves to be put in the position of facing a U.S. armored corps. It's not going to happen. They will seek asymmetric means of attacking us. And I've been to at least a dozen conferences in the last 3 years discussing asymmetrical attacks. This attack was not unexpected. What was unexpected is you don't know what failure mode is going to work against you, and what worked against us was not failure of security at the airlines. This is all a great big magilla. It's all a red herring to get us to have a national ID card. Because security didn't fail that day. Doctrine failed. What do you do if faced with hijackers who are pulling a bluff with a bomb and have a knife? Surrender your airplane, because it's the responsible thing to do and everyone will get out alive. If you fight, everyone will die. Well, the people on UA-93 fought and everyone died. So the old doctrine was right, but the new doctrine is right. You fight because it is going to stop them from doing something even worse. The point is that that's where anticipation failed and resiliency succeeded. Did I answer your question?
Would you speculate about the premise? You like the popular culture. I've watched Dark Angel a couple of times, and the premise is that the electronic communications are disabled all over the world. You ever speculate on that?
There have been some science fiction stories. After the Zap is one of them. Another one is one that I just read in manuscript. What was the woman's name? In which electromagnetic communication suddenly stopped functioning. So the world becomes balkanized. You have to actually physically travel from place to place in order to find out what's going on in these places. Even though they have high technology, it's nevertheless, the world is almost different planets. There have been some very nice science fiction stories along those lines. I'm trying to remember the name of this recent one. It's very cute. It's a whole series by this woman. Our ability to be resilient in the face of change is a very interesting thing. If we had not developed fiber optic communication systems, for instance, the Soviets might have been tempted to do an electromagnetic pulse explosion to knock out our communications. Having parallel sets of things is an interesting thing to encourage in an era when you don't want any too tempting targets. Nexus points. Of course, that was the original idea behind the internet. When you think about it, it is odd that hierarchical power structures would have subsidized the internet. And some people, cynically, they say that's because they didn't know what they were making. And you look back at the documents, and there are great many people involved in the development of the internet who had vague, rough visions of what they were making. What you have to do is you have to readapt your notion of what professionals think. And in the American context, you will sometimes find powerful people who believe in power the way George Marshall, the greatest man of the last century, believed in it, when he said, "I approve of democracy highly, though I suffer from it daily." Yeah. Do you want to talk about literature a little bit? Is that what you came for? Or did you come for this privacy, secrecy, Bryn speculating about things he has no academic degrees in? Well, I'm here because there is one thing I've been trained at. I have degrees in science. I speculate in various things. I'm knowledgeable about the technologies. But my principal role is as a speculator, because I'm good at stepping back and re-examining cliches. Don't take anything I say as gospel, because it would be a stupid thing to do. But I'm good at poking away with questions.
This gentleman had a question right here.
Yeah.
I appreciate the diamond versus the triangle, but I would like you to bullshit about your own opinion is to put the diamond into the triangle, and the triangle actually represents the whole world, and the diamonds are.
Did I know what you were going to say? I'm tolerant to the extent that I believe we can build a civilization in which my children can be exposed to a great many ideas and say to this one, ooh, yuck, but they do have nice beads. That's pretty good, except I don't like that. That's an ideal that we tend to believe in for our children. What I think people need to recognize is that that very ideal is in itself a cultural norm, a cultural meme. And it is incompatible with the basic cultural norms of most of human history. That does not mean that this system, if it wins, quote unquote, won't appreciate diversity. It's just that there are certain fundamental viewpoints that it cannot be compatible with. If it destroys the opponents there, then we'll live in a world in which all the superficial things, the languages, the differences in cultures, the difference will be appreciated. Let me show you what's going on here. You're talking about in setting this diamond here and saying that it's artificial because our wealth and our happiness, our success is on the backs of a real diamond, and that we are an elite here at the top of a pyramid. And it is good for you to point out that potential interpretation because it shows that you're aware of the potential of smugness and you're aware of the potential that we need to look at both moral and ideological failure modes. I have to tell you that you're right and you're wrong. The initial temptation is to believe that this diamond that we're on top of is the third world, that we are rapaciously feeding off the third world in order to support an aristocracy that includes our own poor. We are living off third world resources to some degree, using them up. But the idea that we are exploiting the third world in some way that is decreasing their chances to rise up into a diamond is very easily demolished, utterly demolished, with one simple fact. The more closely a foreign culture economy is enmeshed with ours, the better they're doing. The more detached from our economy a foreign economy is, the worse they are doing. And that is purely true. Now, injustices, yes. Are the people out there demonstrating against globalization, do they have a point? Of course they do. Pressure has to be maintained so that international law follows national law. National law that prevents exploitation of children, that encourages the development of trade unions, that fight for the rights of workers, that fights ecological depredation, that follows the money in kleptocracies. These are all things that, mind you, are very closely related to transparency. One of my favorite charities is called the Witness Program. They buy several thousand cameras every year, obsolete video cameras, that year's seconds, and send them over to borderline countries. They're useless in Iraq. You get shot if you pick up one. But in Latin America, they're doing a huge amount of good because these are borderline countries where enough people gathered together with a camera can get past the local thug cop and get the video to a TV station, and it can do an awful lot of good. You build civil society that way by building local and intermediate level accountability. Now, the globalization people are very frustrating because they are partly reacting out of self-righteous lefty Here's the nearest thing I can throw stuff at. This is Dad, I can throw stuff at it. So they're saying ridiculous things, like globalization is bad when their dads were talking about the UN. They can't parse properly what they're actually asking for. What they're actually asking for is that the rest of the world benefit from law the way we did. And it's hard to ask for that, because if you're anti-authority, how can you actually parse asking for authority? What is going to be the manifestation of a world government? Nobody's discussing world government. And we're terrified of world government. My 8-year-old son told me that he didn't want a world government because if you get one, there's no way out. Very smart. So instead, what we're doing is we're building the institutions and ground-level institutions of world government. World Trade Organization, telecommunications union, the internet governance organizations, and a fourth or fifth house of the world legislature is this tent that has to be set up near every international meeting for the non-governmental organizations. And the harm that was done being done by the anti-globalization people is immeasurable, because it's forcing world leaders to become Bilderbergers hiding out in Qatar, in the Cayman Islands, when the tradition that was building was you got to have this tent. Huge tent. Beijing didn't want it, and we insisted they couldn't have a big trade meeting there unless they set up the tent. They wanted to have it be in another city 500 miles away. And our governmental representative said, no, you must set up the tent within 3 miles of the meeting venue. But an inability amid their self-righteousness to parse out the sophistication of the world that they're in made these anti-globalization marchers into a highly destructive force against their own agenda. When what they should be saying is, we're worried about globalization only benefiting the aristocracy. Well, duh! Where are the laws that are going to hold these corporations accountable? Where are the laws that are going to spread the wealth? Where are the laws that are going to ensure that the result is a diamond? Now, that's a more sophisticated thing to say, and raised on the drug of self-righteousness and suspicion of authority, it's very hard to get outraged young people to actually parse that out. It's a damn shame, because now we've got the Bilderberg. Now we've got the world leaders going to Bilderberg hideouts. Partly because of terrorism now. They're using that as an excuse. But it's partly to hide from all the young people in the streets, and it's a damn shame. Yeah?
Metaphor, we do need to be wrapping this up. So I was wondering if anybody had any last question or comment before we take
the question. Yeah, he's been waiting there. He's been steaming.
Not necessarily. Just in response to what you were discussing, I was wondering
I think it's hurt their aspirations immensely, because they have not parsed out what they want. They haven't parsed out what they want because globalization is the only way third world peoples are going to be rescued from their own kleptocratic elites. Now, replacing them with our own rapacious elites is not going to be a good idea unless our elites are followed in there with our good laws. And even better laws than our good laws. Laws to restrict environmental rape, to restrict child labor, and all of these other things, and encourage the development of trade unions. This is exactly what I'm talking about. Seeing what the problem is and negotiating from a position of strength is very important for the freedom-loving people. Another example is the national ID card. It may not come this time, it'll come after the next crisis. If not after that one, it's going to come after the crisis after that, because people will panic into it. Already Larry Ellison of Oracle Corporation is pushing it. And you know what? If we don't get it made as a national ID card, it'll happen through SkyD. Ever heard of SkyD? It's an ID card that has your thumbprint in it that you can show with your picture, latest biometrics. You show it, thumbprint, you go through security. In other words, a convenience card, a positive thing, like the supermarket club card. In other words, a national ID card will sneak up on us through convenience. And then the onerous checks for the people who don't have them will go up and up and up, just like the prices in the stores went up and up and up for people who don't happen to have the supermarket scanner card. We're going to have a national ID card. Now, you can fight it in the streets. You can fight it in the courts. You can fight it the FBI to try to keep them blind. Or you can recognize that it's just plain dumb to try to keep elites from seeing, because elites will see. All you're going to do, if you try to banish the cameras, is make them smaller. As Robert Heinlein said, the only effect of privacy laws is to make the bugs smaller. But we could do something else. We could say, we understand, FBI, that you're going to have to keep a better idea of what's going on. You're going to have to see better in order to protect us. We understand, INS, that you're going to have to keep track of every person who comes in here under a visa and know what they're doing. We understand that. Now, here is the card. Here's the visa. Here's even a national ID card. Come on, come on, come on. Now strip. That is how we've kept our freedom. Not by blinding government, but by making sure that we can see them. Freedom of information laws, open meeting laws, open testimony laws, accountability systems. I could name half a dozen that would just be marvelous, that would really irk the hell out of all our FBI agents and all the CIA guys down the line, but they would have to admit that it would not harm them from doing their jobs. It would just embarrass them. And that's what they want secrecy for. They don't want to be held accountable. And our only chance is to hold them accountable. No, don't blind the FBI. Don't blind the CIA. Make them strip. Make sure that they can't do anything without it being recorded, without knowing that they might be held accountable for it someday. That would work. Was that a goodbye or was that a question?
I guess I'd like to thank David for coming here today.
Thank you. Would none of you brought books for me to sign? Well, I have some book plates here if you happen to be fans. Unfortunately, they are not Transparent Society book plates. They are Kiln People book plates.